16. Another turbo elevator hurtled us downward at an unsettling speed, then slowed to a stop just a few seconds later. A screen embedded in the wall displayed a 3D map of the base, and it indicated that we'd just arrived at its lowest level, at the very bottom of the egg-shaped structure nestled into the Daedalus crater. When the doors hissed open, we stepped out into a short, blue-carpeted corridor that terminated in a pair of sliding armored doors with Drone Operations Center neatly stenciled across them. Above these doors, spray-painted on the wall in stylized graffiti, was the name Thunderdome. The doors slid open as we approached, and I followed my father through them into a large, circular room with a domed concrete ceiling that was painted a bright iridescent blue, like the screens that were used on movie sets as placeholders for digital effects that would be added later. "Welcome," my father said, stretching out his arms, "to the Moonbase Alpha Drone Operations Center. We call it the Thunderdome." "Why?" "Well, because it has a dome," he said, pointing up. "And we fight inside it, just like Mad Max," he shrugged. "And because Thunderdome sounds cooler than Drone Operations Center." In the center of the room, on a raised platform, was a rotating command chair with curved ergonomic touchscreens built into its armrests. It was encircled by 10 oval-shaped pits sunken into the stone floor, each containing an individual drone controller pod. Unlike the multifunction stations we'd used back at Crystal Palace, these pods appeared to have been designed to control interceptors exclusively. Each pit contained a simulated ADI-88 interceptor cockpit, a pilot seat, flight stick, and all of its familiar control panels and system indicators arrayed beneath a wraparound display canopy that slid into place over you when you climbed into the pilot seat. My father tapped a button on his QCOM, and the bright blue dome over our heads switched on, like the screen of a high-definition television, providing a 360-degree view of the cratered landscape surrounding the moon base that made it seem as if we were standing in the observation deck on the base's top level instead of in a reinforced bunker far beneath the lunar surface. As he led me across the enormous domed bunker, I glanced inside each of the drone controller pods at my feet. I could see through their semi-transparent canopies, and four of the pods were already in use. Debbie, Milo, Wodey, and Chen were inside, giving their new rigs a test spin in some sort of training simulation. The Japanese EDA officer I'd spotted earlier was standing at the command console with another EDA officer, a tall, dark-skinned man I'd never seen before. Both men looked about the same age as my father, and both had the same weary, battle-hardened demeanor I'd seen in him. As they walked over to greet us, I glanced down at the collars of their uniforms and saw they both held the rank of major. "Zach, I'd like you to meet two of my oldest friends," my father said. "Major Shin Hashimoto and Major Graham Fogg." "Konnichiwa, Lightman-san," Major Shin said. I saluted him, but he threw me off by returning it with a bow. "It's good to finally meet you. Your father has told me way too much about you over the years," he grinned. "I've gotten pretty sick of it, actually." "Sorry," I said, just to have something to say. Shin studied my face until it started to feel creepy. Then he glanced over at my father, then back at me, comparing our faces. "Holy Toledo," he said, whistling. "You really are the spitting image of your old man." He elbowed me in the ribs, grinning broadly. "My sympathies, kid." He laughed heartily at his own joke, and my father gave me an apologetic look, the same look I used to give to my mom when one of my friends came over and broke something. But I laughed politely in return, then turned to shake hands with Major Fogg, who appeared to be the tallest person on the moon.
"It is my distinct pleasure to meet you, Lieutenant Lightman," he said brightly. He surprised me by speaking with a thick British accent. "Welcome to Moonbase Alpha."
I glanced at the shoulder of his uniform and saw the Union Jack there instead of a U.S. flag. I also noticed that the word defense on his EDA insignia was spelled with a C instead of an S.
"It's just the three of you?"
I asked. No one else is up here? Just us, Shin said. A resupply shuttle comes up twice a month, but the rest of the time, we're all alone. Not counting all of the drones, of course. Graham nodded. The Alliance used to have dozens of people stationed up here to help keep all of the different systems running smoothly, he said. But once the QCOM network came online, almost everything could be done remotely with drones, so they cut back to just a skeleton crew made up of essential military personnel. There used to be a few more pilots stationed up here, my father added, including Admiral Vance. But now it's just us. The Three Musketeers, Graham said, smiling. Lucky buggers that we are. A long folding wooden table and three folding metal chairs were arranged against the far wall. The table's surface was covered with a variety of Dungeons & Dragons rulebooks, gaming screens, and dozens of oddly shaped dice. We play D&D 4 or 5 nights a week, Graham explained when he saw me eyeing the setup. Helps to pass the time. Shin is usually our dungeon master. He smiled at me. My character is 27th level Elven Archer. Why don't you show him your character sheet, Graham? Shin said. That will really impress the kid. Graham ignored him and continued to shadow me with an enthusiastic smile as I wandered around the control center, like a kid showing off his room. A short distance away, I spotted a large drum kit, 2 electric guitars, and 3 mic stands, flanked on either side by a stack of amplifiers. I wandered over to examine the gear. What, do you guys have a band or something? I asked. Indeed we do, Graham said proudly. We call ourselves the Bishop of Battle. It's the name of the short film starring Emilio Estevez, I finished for him, from the Nightmares Horror Anthology. My father and both his friends blinked at me in surprise as goofy grins spread across each of their faces. I grinned back, then nodded at my father. I saw it when I was working my way through all of your old VHS tapes. I cut myself off when I realized how revealing my last statement had been. But none of them noticed. They were all still beaming at me for getting their band name. I like this kid, Xavier, Shin said. My father nodded. Yeah, so do I. We can play some pretty decent Van Halen covers, Graham continued. Maybe we'll jam for you guys later. Sure, I said uncertainly. That would be cool. I glanced back over at my father, but he was staring at his feet and shaking his head in embarrassment. We're not going to play for them, Graham, I told you, he muttered. Aliens are invading in a few hours, remember? What better reason to rock out one last time? Graham replied, throwing up 2 sets of devil horns. I stepped over to the edge of the nearest drone controller station pit and peeked in. There was an out-of-order sign scotch-taped to its tactical display. What happened to this one? I asked. Graham spilled Coke Zero on it, that's what, Shin said. Cost the war effort millions. Stop trying to pin that on me, Graham grumbled back. You left your sandals lying around and I tripped over them. Those millions are on you, Shinbone. Graham laughed, but when I laughed too, he scowled at me. What's so bloody funny, kid? He said. I fried 1 drone pod. That's nothing compared to the zillions of dollars in drones we lost this morning, thanks to your little stunt. Shin nodded, and they both continued to scowl at me for a few more seconds before they both burst into laughter. Ha 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 ha! I'm joking, lad, Graham said, still laughing. I must have watched the video clip of you chasing that glaive into the base 50 times so far today. Priceless, that was. Shin shook his head. How did you stop Viper from murdering you for that? Maybe he realized I'm already a dead man, so there was no point. My father frowned at me and seemed about to say something, but Shin changed the subject before he could. Care for some snackage, Lieutenant? He asked. Your favorite snacks were listed on each of your EDA profiles, so we stocked up on all of them. You're a Lucky Charms man, right? Dry, with no milk? We laid in a few dozen boxes for you, see? He pointed over at one of the unoccupied pods across the room, where 6 boxes of my favorite breakfast cereal sat stacked up like crates of ammunition. The other new recruits had an assortment of snacks and beverages laid out on the floor around their sunken pods, too. Stacks of nacho cheese combos and Slim Jims were scattered around Milo's pod, along with a small mountain of Diet Mountain Dew. There were bags of cheddar jalapeno Cheetos and a row of 2-liter bottles of Hawaiian Punch laid out for Wody, bags of multicolored Skittles for Debbie, and beside Chen's pod, dozens of silver energy drink cans with QILI printed on the side, surrounded by writing in Chinese. "How did our favorite snacks end up in our EDA profiles?" I asked Shin. But it was Graham who answered.
"The EDA knows everything about everyone, kid," he said. "Your food and beverage preferences weren't the only things being recorded while you were playing Armada and Terra Firma, trust me. Your pulse rate, blood pressure, sweat content. The EDA makes the CIA and the NSA look like the PTA.
"Great," I said. "The government has been spying on all of us our whole lives, but at least we get to have our favorite snacks. Bonus." To my surprise, my father grinned at my remark. Just then, the other new arrivals emerged from their pods, and he went over to greet them. Chen snapped to attention when he saw my father approach, and the others scrambled to follow suit.
"At ease, recruits," my father said as he walked over to them. "Welcome to Moonbase Alpha. I'm General Xavier Lightman, your new CO. I apologize for keeping you waiting."
He scanned their faces, waiting for a response, but my new friends all seemed too starstruck to speak. My father walked over to stand in front of Milo, who was grinning like he was about to meet one of his favorite movie stars, his earlier disdain apparently forgotten.
"You're Milo Dobson, right? Better known as Cushmaster 5000?
Milo nodded imperceptibly, caught in the throes of some sort of gamer fanboy aneurysm.
"It's an honor to finally meet you in person, Lieutenant Dobson," my father told him. He turned to the others. "It's an honor to meet all of you. Wody, Crazy G, Atomic Mom."
He shook hands with each of them in turn, then nodded at me. "And of course, Iron Beagle.
You're five of the most gifted pilots I've ever seen in action. We're privileged to have you here."
The others smiled and their faces flushed with pride, and mine may have a bit as well.
"Thank you, sir," Chen said, carefully repeating his QCOM's translation.
"Yeah, thanks, General," Milo said, finally recovering from his stroke of paralysis. "I mean, holy shit, that's a huge compliment coming from Red Jive himself. You're the best of the best of the best, sir. I've been studying your moves for years. We all have."
My father seemed genuinely embarrassed by this praise. "You're giving me way too much credit," he said. Then he pointed to his two comrades. "Shin and Graham were both heavily involved with your simulator training, too. I'm sure you'll recognize their call signs. Shin uses the handle Max Genius, and Graham..."
"My call sign is with Nailed," Graham finished, "though these two rarely use it."
"We prefer to call him Limes instead," Shin said. "It's short for Limey. He hates it."
Graham nodded. "Indeed I do."
We all smiled in recognition at their familiar call signs. Max Genius and With Nailed were both mainstays in the top 5 pilot rankings, too. Since the first year the game was launched, they had both alternated between 2nd and 3rd place, right below Red Jive.
"I don't mean to be rude, General Lightman," Debbie said, "but when are you going to tell us why the EDA sent us up here?"
She glanced over at Shin and Graham.
"Why couldn't we just remain back on Earth with the other recruits?"
My father exchanged a strange smile with his two friends, then nodded at Debbie.
"I was just about to brief all of you on that subject," he said.
Graham smiled. Then he motioned to a row of low, padded leather bench seats behind us.
"You guys might want to be sitting down when you hear this," he said, before sitting down himself.
Milo and Debbie joined him, but Chen, Wody, and I remained on our feet. My father waved his hand at the view screen covering the domed ceiling, and the image arrayed across it changed. We were no longer looking at a live feed of the lunar landscape outside the base, but at an animated 3-dimensional graphic of our solar system, with the spinning planet Earth in the foreground and the moon lazily orbiting it at a distance, both surrounded by a series of concentric rings indicating the orbital paths of the other planets. My father made another gesture at the screen, and the animation of our solar system began to speed up, making the planets zoom around the sun like a pack of race cars, each on a separate track. One of the things you weren't told during your enlistment briefing is that this isn't the first time the Europans have sent ships to Earth to attack us, the general said. Over the past 4 decades, they've done it exactly 37 times. On the domed screen, the celestial clockwork of our solar system continued to spin forward until the orbits of Earth and Jupiter aligned, bringing the two planets into their closest annual proximity. Then, as the orbit of Jupiter's moon, Europa, brought it as close as possible to Earth, the animation froze. Every 398.9 days, a celestial event known as the Jovian opposition occurs, the general explained. When the Sun and Jupiter are both on opposite sides of Earth, and Europa is at its closest proximity to us. Ever since our first contact with them, the Europans have used that proximity to send a small detachment of ships to Earth to conduct surveillance, test our defenses, and abduct live human specimens for study. He tapped his QCOM display, and an image of Moonbase Alpha appeared on the screen, seen from above, nestled into the Daedalus crater. Once the Europans began to send scouting missions to Earth, the EDA decided to construct a secret defense base here on the far side of the moon, the general said. It was originally intended to function as a long-range surveillance and communications outpost, but when it finally became operational in September of 1988 and a permanent human presence was established here, the enemy's tactics changed. When the next Jovian opposition arrived, the Europans didn't send their detachment of scout ships directly to Earth. This time, they came here to Moonbase Alpha first and attacked it. Video footage began to play on the domed view screen, showing a large formation of Glaive fighters streaking down from the starry blackness of the lunar sky to descend on the tiny moon base nestled in the crater below, as interceptors began to launch out of the base's hangar and fly up to meet them, setting off a massive aerial battle. "We managed to fight them off, but just barely," he said. "It took nearly a full year to repair the damage. And when the next Jovian opposition arrived, the Europans attacked again, this time with an even larger force, to match the increased size of Moonbase Alpha's defenses. And, once again, our forces were barely a match for them." "The same thing happened again the next year," Graham said, "and the year after that." "Each year they sent even more drones to assault the base," Shin said. "And every year, we increased our defenses here in anticipation of their next attack." My father nodded. "This escalation continued for over a decade, until the Europans changed the game on us again last year by unveiling a new weapon, one you've all encountered before during your Armada training, the Disruptor." A collective groan escaped the new recruits. On the view screen, we watched as a cluster of enemy ships appeared, descending toward Moonbase Alpha in perfect formation, creating an image that momentarily resembled a screenshot of the game Space Invaders. A wireframe diagram of a spinning dodecahedron appeared adjacent to it on the view screen, and I felt the hair on the back of my neck stand up. "The Disruptor appears to function by coupling itself to a large celestial body, like a planet or moon." On the view screen, an animation showed a spinning chrome dodecahedron making landfall on Earth and then firing a beam of red energy into the planet's core. "The device then harnesses the planet's magnetic field, using it to generate a spherical field that disrupts all quantum communications inside it." "All of the EDA's drones have backup radio control units," Shin added. "Unfortunately, the Disruptor interferes with normal radio communications too, so they're useless." On the view screen, the emerald green Disruptor began to generate a transparent sphere of red energy that enveloped the entire planet Earth, along with its entire atmosphere, causing the EDA's drones to fall out of the sky. But the moon was outside of the Disruptor's range, as was the secret EDA defense base on its far side.
The quantum disruption effect only works if the transmitting and receiving ends of a link are both contained inside its spherical field, the general said. If either the drone or its operator are located outside of the disruption field, the quantum link is completely unaffected and remains intact. If the enemy manages to couple their disruptor to the Earth, only the EDA personnel stationed up here on the moon, that's us, will still be able to control the drones we have stockpiled back on Earth, and vice versa. My father flipped away from the wireframe animation and back to the footage of the enemy fighters, revealing a large, onyx-colored dodecahedron, a dark, multifaceted jewel spinning in their midst. The object pulsed rapidly in color, from jet black to molten red along its illuminated, angular seams. Just before the Europans attacked this base during the last opposition, they activated the disruptor, coupling it to the moon's magnetic field, which is relatively weak compared to that of Earth. As he spoke, the pulsing dodecahedron fired a red beam of energy into the moon's core. It began to generate a spherical field of energy around itself, which increased rapidly in diameter until it completely covered Moonbase Alpha, along with large patches of the moon's surface, which I knew from our briefing was in a pattern that matched the moon's inherent magnetic field. When the disruptor switched on, it knocked out our ability to control drones from here inside the base, my father explained. But all of the EDA drone pilots located back on Earth were unaffected because they were outside the disruption field. Shin pulled a different graphic up on the screen, showing Earth and its nearby moon, the far side of which was covered by the disruptor's transparent field, which was enormous, but not large enough to envelop both the moon and Earth at the same time. The enemy's drones continued to function for the same reason, my father said. Their operators were back on Europa, hundreds of thousands of miles outside the disruption field. Shin nodded. This base has a backup hardline intranet, he said. So we were still able to defend the base using the surface guns and with tethered backup drones, which were all hardwired and thus unaffected by the disruptor. On the screen, footage showed sentry guns all over the exterior of the base, powering on and returning fire as the enemy Glaive and Wyvern fighters kept right on attacking, raining down a steady barrage of laser fire and plasma bolts on the base defenses. Down on the surface, a few dozen tethered Aethids and Warmechs also continued to defend the base, unspooling their fiber-optic tether cables behind them, which drastically limited their mobility, effectiveness, and range. The EDA sent several squadrons of reinforcement interceptors up here from Earth, he explained. And with their help, we were eventually able to destroy the disruptor, but the base was badly damaged, and we barely survived the attack. Is a real disruptor as difficult to destroy as the ones in the game? Chen asked via his QCOM. Shin, Graham, and my father all nodded. Then how did you guys manage to take it down? I asked. Shin and Graham both grinned as if they'd been waiting for this question. It takes two to make a thing go right, Shin recited, smiling cryptically. Graham nodded, then added, It takes two to make it out of sight. They looked as if they were about to recite more of the song's lyrics, but my father shook his head slightly and they both fell silent, waiting for him to continue. Some people think we got lucky, my father said, glancing at Shin. Personally, I think the Europans allowed us to destroy it. Why would they do that? Debbie asked. Good question, my father said. Here, watch the footage and decide for yourself. He tapped his QCOM again, and another grainy video clip began to play on the view screen. This footage was shot from one of Moonbase Alpha's surface surveillance cameras, Shin said, approximately 23 minutes into their attack. All quantum and radio communication is still being jammed by the disruptor. Most of the base, and nearly all of its surface defenses, have been destroyed by this point. On the view screen, the smoking ruins of the moon base were visible in the background, its orb-shaped exterior crawling with spider-like alien drones skittering across its armored metal skin and burrowing into it with lasers. In the foreground, just beyond the lip of the Daedalus crater, was the mammoth disruptor dodecahedron, spinning fiercely just above the lunar surface as it blasted its pulsing red coupler beam down into the moon's magnetic core. In the velvet-black lunar sky above, hundreds of interceptors were launching an assault on the disruptor's shield, firing on it from as many different angles.
"As you'll recall from your training, the disruptor has only one weakness," Shin said. "A steady barrage of laser fire and plasma bolts will bring down its shields, but the disruptor's power core is so large that it recovers far more rapidly than any of the enemy's other drones. Its shields only drop for about 3 seconds, then come right back up at full strength."
"And 3 seconds isn't long enough to destroy it," Milo said. "At least, it never was in the game. That's why no one has ever taken down a disruptor, not even the Flying Circus."
"Look," Shin pointed at the screen. "Here he comes to save the day."
On the screen, a lone EDA mech appeared, power leaping across the lunar surface, fearlessly charging toward the pillar of blinding red light created by the disruptor's transparent coupler beam.
"Old Viper Vance," Graham shook his head in admiration. "Watch him go."
"Admiral Vance is controlling that mech?" Wodey asked.
"Yes," my father said. "But he was still just a general back then. He used to be in command of Moonbase Alpha. I took over his post when he got promoted to admiral, in part for the act of bravery we're watching now."
"Although Viper used to do crazy shit like this all the time," Shin added, "that guy was fearless."
"I'm sure he still is," my father said quietly, his eyes still on the screen.
We continued to watch the silent footage of General Vance's charge toward the disruptor, wondering what would happen when he closed the remaining distance to it.
"How was he controlling that mech with the disruptor still in operation?" I wondered aloud, still studying the footage intently.
"He's moving too fast to have a tether, isn't he?"
My father nodded. "You're right, he is," he said. "Tethered drones were always too slow and too vulnerable for Vance's liking."
He nodded at the screen. "He's piloting that mech from inside it. There's a cockpit embedded in its torso just above its power core, which Viper is setting to overload right about now." On the screen, Vance's mech came within arm's reach of the coupler beam, and then suddenly went limp and fell to the surface like a giant metal rag doll, throwing up a cloud of dust.
"He set his mech to self-destruct from inside it?" Milo said disbelievingly. "Did the old man have a death wish?"
Shin and Graham nodded. Then Shin motioned to my father.
"I used to think he and General Lightman here both did."
I pointed up at the screen.
"But he isn't going to have time to eject."
My father nodded.
"Vance's escape pod launch system was damaged during his charge, so now he's trapped there next to his own time bomb."
I had already started counting down the 7 seconds it would take for his power core overload sequence to complete, but I'd only hit 5 when 2 more mechs appeared, running up from the bottom of the video frame. Laser and plasma fire rained down on them from the dogfight still raging in the dark sky above the burning, half-destroyed moon base. Then I heard a familiar classic rock song blasting over Vance's comm, a song from my father's Raid the Arcade mix, Black Betty by Ram Jam.
"That's one of our nicknames for a disruptor now," Shin said, nodding at the spinning black dodecahedron on the screen. "A Black Betty, or a ten-sider."
I continued to study the view screen. As the 2 Titan war mechs bounded toward the motionless one containing Vance, they moved in a strange sort of unison, almost like a pair of synchronized swimmers. They both seemed to dodge and zigzag perfectly again and again, just in time to avoid being obliterated, always in forward motion, seemingly oblivious to the geysers of rock and moon dust erupting all around and sometimes directly ahead of them. Shin paused the video.
"Your father is operating both of those mechs simultaneously. He's inside the one on the left, and it's connected to the mech on the right via a short fiber optic tether inside a titanium-reinforced cable stretching between them."
"Shin would know," my father said, never taking his eyes off the screen. "He finished helping me rig them together about 10 minutes before this footage was shot."
Shin pressed play again, and my eyes were drawn back to the screen. I watched as two mechs lumber forward, unloading their sun guns and laser cannons into the disruptor's massive spherical shield as they passed underneath its mammoth spinning form and the coupler array at its southern pole. Then, the mech my father was in reached Vance's mech, ripped its escape pod free with Vance inside, and tucked it under his arm like a football. A ring of explosive bolts fired around the armored cable, tethering my father's mech to the one beside it, severing their connection. My father's drone threw Vance's now limp drone skyward like a shot put toward the disruptor's still-shielded coupler array. In the same motion, he power-leaped in the opposite direction while hurling Vance's escape pod in front of him a bare second before ejecting his own. Both of their pods flew out of the frame just before Vance's mech finally completed its 7-second self-destruct countdown and detonated. 2 seconds later, the drone my father had hurled skyward did the exact same thing, a perfectly timed 1-2 punch, a nearly impossible shot, like a 3-pointer from full court with 1 second on the clock. But even that amazing bit of timing wasn't enough, because just before both mechs would have impacted against the disruptor's transparent shield, the shield dropped, leaving the dodecahedron unprotected for that narrow 3-second window while its massive power core recharged enough to power its defenses back up. It was during this incredibly short sliver of time that both mechs detonated, one after the next. The first detonation struck the disruptor's diamond-hard hull, but its armor appeared to absorb the blast somehow, and the triangular facets of the dodecahedron's skin lit up molten orange as the energy dissipated across them. Only when the second mech detonated a half-second later did the disruptor's weakened armor finally fail in an explosion that took out the disruptor itself. Graham and Shin both broke into applause. I got the feeling they had watched this footage on a regular basis and that they applauded like this every time. Wody, Milo, Debbie, and Chen all applauded too, but I abstained. I was too busy staring at the screen. "Can we watch that footage again?" I asked. "At half speed this time?" Shin nodded and ran it again. Then he ended up running it for us several more times at everyone's request. The footage became more impressive and more unsettling to watch with each viewing. My father had truly pulled off a one-in-a-million shot. If the disruptor's shields had failed a split second earlier or later, his attack would have failed too. And studying the time counter on the video clip, it looked as if the disruptor's shield stayed down a fraction of a second longer than it should have, just long enough for my father to pull off a miracle. "How many more disruptors are on their way here right now?" Milo asked fearfully. "You left that little detail out of your briefing." "3, my father said. "There's one disruptor accompanying each wave of their invasion force." "3? Milo repeated. "There's no way we'll be able to destroy 3 disruptors one after the other, not with a massive alien shitstorm coming down on us." My father nodded. "Yes, I'd say that's a real long shot. But we do have one last card up our sleeves. The icebreaker." "But I thought the icebreaker mission already failed," Debbie said. "It was destroyed before the melt laser even breached the surface of Sobrakai. Europa, I mean." "The icebreaker you escorted last night was destroyed, yes," my father said. "But we had a contingency plan. We hoped we might be able to destroy the Europans before they launched their armada, but we knew our chance of success was extremely slim. So we constructed a second icebreaker, which was hidden inside a hollowed-out asteroid and placed into orbit around Jupiter to avoid detection by the Europans. As soon as their armada departed for Earth, leaving Europa unprotected, we launched the icebreaker. It's already on its way."
"When will it get there?"
"It should reach Europa about the same time the second wave of the enemy's armada reaches Earth."
"What if we don't survive the first wave?" Debbie asked.
"Then the icebreaker won't make any difference," Shin said. "But that's why we have to make sure we do survive, because then we may finally get our chance to end this war once and for all."
I waited for Graham or my father to agree with Shin, but both of them were silent. "Anyone hungry?" my father asked. He held up his QCOM.
I just got word the drones have finished preparing our dinner in the mess hall.
Thank God, Milo shouted, already moving toward the exit. I was afraid that Cheetos and root beer would be my last meal. Let's eat.
Wody and Debbie nodded in agreement, as did Chen once he heard the translation.
I don't have much of an appetite, I said. If I was about to die, I wanted the breakfast my mother made for me that morning to be my last meal, not some Salisbury steak dinner reheated in a moonbase microwave.
My father nodded, and he and Shin began to lead the others toward the exit. Graham saw me straggling behind and threw an arm around me.
Trust me, you'll change your mind once you see the spread up there, Graham said. They sent up a special 5-course gourmet meal for us on your shuttle.
Why? Debbie asked. Because it will probably be our last meal?
Probably, Graham replied, giving me a grim smile as he quickened his pace toward the exit. That's why I, for one, intend to stuff my face.